Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Welcome to the Center of Everywhere, a podcast from the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Today, we're excited to revisit one of our most popular episodes, where we dive into rural mental health. This conversation resonated with so many of you, highlighting key issues and insights that continue to shape rural communities. Whether you're tuning in for the first time or revisiting this episode, we're glad to have you with us as we explore what it takes to strengthen and support rural Minnesota and beyond.
So today, we're going to talk about our latest report, The Suicide Epidemic in Rural Minnesota, which can be found on our website at ruralmn.org. And joining me today will be our co-author, or my co-author on that report, Dr. Tracy Rutherford Self. Tracy is on the faculty of Minnesota State University, Mankato, and she is a researcher for the Center for Rural Behavioral Health, which is located there. She's also a suicidologist, a specialist in the subject of suicide. So thanks for being on the podcast today, Tracy.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So Tracy, why are we seeing the steady upward trend in suicides, and where does that despair come from? We hear about deaths of despair, diseases of despair. We heard that that's what's driving this. What's your take on this?
So I think there are a lot of factors to consider. I mean, in the general population, again, we are seeing those increases, and we're seeing them for a number of reasons. So one of those is really just a lack of overall access to mental health care for the general population. And there's a number of reasons. There's a lack of access. We do have some provider shortage needs that we're just not able to provide for as many of the individuals who would seek care. But as much as that, we have a lot of individuals who simply choose not to seek care. They tend to try to care for themselves. They seek out assistance from family or friends who often may not be well equipped. And frankly, there's just an extent to which some people feel their situations are so difficult and so desperate, they simply don't see any other options or ways out of this. You know, it's really interesting. We know, particularly in rural communities, one of the things that happens is individuals who die by suicide often do not have a mental health diagnosis at any point, which means they likely have not been in to see a provider. And again, that goes back to that lack of access of care, but also the lack of acceptability of care. So they simply may not be seeking out care even when they are able to access it. So I think that's a lot of the rationale. Now, there are other driving factors. Economics is certainly one of them. So whether or not individuals believe they can afford to access care, there may be a lack of insurance, a lack of understanding of what's being provided from a financial perspective, or how to obtain care if there's some concerns about the ability to fund that care. We also see a lot of suicide rates increasing around substance use issues. So when we have issues related to substance use and substance misuse, then we have greater levels of suicidality. Marnie, I apologize. There was a little bit more to that question. Can you go back and kindly remind
me? Oh, sure. Well, where does, you know, we talk about deaths of despair, diseases of despair, you know, which goes to the drug use and the alcohol use that you're talking about. That's part of it. What else, you know, you're talking about what else is part of it. And also, what are there, you know, we found from studying the data that rural areas are more affected. There's just a higher rate of suicide in rural areas. Are there groups within these, you know, are there subgroups within these groups that are more susceptible or more affected?
Absolutely. So, you know, for the longest time, this was believed to be a disorder that impacted primarily middle-aged white men. And the truth is that still tends to be our highest demographic, which, as you know, is overrepresented in rural communities. Often our rural communities have a large population of middle-aged white men. But the truth is, we also have to look at this from different perspectives. So it's increased substantially among youth between the ages of 10 to 24. In fact, it is the second leading cause of death among that population. And it accounts for more death by suicide than when we account for all natural causes in the 10 to 24 year age population. And while we didn't specifically look at this for youth who are younger than the age of 10, there's actually a pretty substantive increase from about 6 to 12 overall as well. While that number still hasn't risen to the devastating effects we see in youth 10 to 24, it certainly has increased. And for rural populations, again, some of that really comes back to access to care. Often we're having to see kiddos who might need to have access to mental health care outside of their communities if there aren't providers there. And we're doing a great job of trying to put people in schools and in locations in Minnesota, but it still is not able to reach everyone. And so children might have to leave their hometown and access care elsewhere, which often may lead to missing school. And so there's the challenges of which need kind of comes first. Are we going to access care outside the hometown, or are we going to be able to stay in school and not miss out on some of those activities as well? We noticed a pretty dramatic increase during COVID for Black Americans and African Americans. So it was really interesting to look at that data because in 2020, when we started looking at the 2020 data for suicide, we had anticipated a really substantive increase in the overall population for suicide. But we actually didn't see that. The 2020 data actually showed a decrease overall in suicide rates. And when we started parsing apart the data, so as researchers across the country started looking at that, what they noted was there actually was a substantive increase for Black Americans around suicide and COVID. So while it had decreased for white middle-class populations, it had substantially increased for Black populations. And we think a lot of that had to do with the political unrest that was happening during that time period. We can also go back and correlate it to data around, say, George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And when we have those incidents, you'll actually see a pretty sharp and substantive increase in those populations for suicidality. The other thing that we talk about are some of our other diverse populations. So, veteran populations, Native populations, LGBTQ populations, those have been historically high for a number of years. And again, in rural populations, even more so because of access to care issues, but also even just the accessibility piece. And again, I go back to the idea of acceptability. So, when I say acceptability, one of the things I'm referencing is this idea that there's often been stigma with rural communities. And in those rural communities, it may not be as acceptable to reach back out to receive mental health care because of that stigma.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about stigma. You know, what is it? What does it look like in rural communities? Why is it so important that we talk about this?
So I think the first thing when we talk about stigma is we have to recognize there has been a shift, probably in the last couple of decades around mental health overall. So the positive news is I feel like it's less concerning the stigma of mental health than it has been probably ever in the history of our country. So more people are willing to reach out. But there's still a lot of isolation, particularly among rural populations, and a lot of this need to take care of our own. So we may feel uncomfortable as a rural society reaching out to a professional, but often what people will do is reach out to family and friends, as I kind of noted previously, in order to access some support. So it just is still this idea that, you know, if I walk into the office of a counselor, people are going to think I'm quote unquote crazy. Or, you know, a friend of mine and I have discussed this idea that the word mental health has often been used, the word mental, as a negative stereotype quite frequently. So this idea still pervades rural communities to a great extent that if I seek help, I'm somehow admitting I'm crazy. I'm admitting I'm less than on some level. And it really goes back to that sort of prevalent idea of the myth of meritocracy, which is if I just try hard enough, I can pull myself up by my bootstraps. And that is really prevalent in the context of those rural communities, is that I should be able to do this on my own. I should be able to think my way out of these negative and dark ideas. And if only I tried harder, or if I thought more positively, I'd be able to do that. And unfortunately, for people who are in that state who are thinking, if I just tried harder, I could do this, they aren't recognizing the connection that the brain has sometimes with those more difficult negative thoughts and the fact that it really often has a biological basis. And because of that biological basis, it simply may not be something they can do on their own.
Now, in terms of stigma, is one of the issues that's more, I mean, with stigma around mental health has been around for ages everywhere, but it's been a little heavier in rural communities. One of the other big things that we talked about in the paper was rural cultural competence, and this was in the context of getting more providers into rural areas. If we get more mental health care providers into rural areas, they need to be, quote, the right providers. They need to be people who understand rural culture, and there is a rural culture. Now, you're a mental health counselor. You grew up in a rural area. You practiced in rural Iowa for many years before coming to Minnesota State, Mankato. What is the rural culture, and why is it so important that healthcare providers are proficient in it, and especially when it comes to mental health?
Yeah, I think all those things are very accurate when we look at the idea that if you're going to be providing for members of a small town, it's perhaps going to be different than even the way you may have been trained to provide as a clinician. So all of our training, whether it's around suicide or mental health, comes with this broad-based lens. And the broad-based lens is that you have this client and this client's going to behave in a certain way. But we have to look at it from their cultural viewpoint. And so often we do that from a race perspective, a low SES perspective, even a gender perspective. But I don't think historically, as a field, we've done a great job of looking at this from the difference between more suburban, urban, and rural populations. And rural culture is a very rare thing, real thing. As you noted, I grew up in rural Appalachia. And the other thing I can tell you is that rural Appalachia is very different than the rural upper Midwest. They do have some common components. So things like high levels of independence. And I kind of want to go back and state, when we talk about this, there are many positive aspects to rural confidence. So we want to look at the strengths of the culture. And so independence is a really strong value among rural populations. Strong work ethic is another one that's a really strong characteristic we see individuals from rural cultures coming into, being very family oriented, being very like community oriented. One of my favorite sayings is if you don't know what you're doing in a small community, ask your neighbor, they certainly do. Now, sometimes we could take that as a potential negative, right? Except I think in this context, it actually, and we saw this in some of our interviews in the report as well, can come back to say, look, we can take care of each other. And that again is a really strong value system. But you have to know that when you start to see clients from rural communities, you have to understand how important it is for them to maintain their independence, to be seen as strong and capable, and also help them understand the value of getting mental health care when things are difficult, because so often it feels like a sense of weakness for them. And so if you have someone coming in to a session for the first time, and they're not really sure. And there is also a little distrust of practitioners if you're not coming from that rural community, because frankly, institutions of higher education kind of have a little bit of a trust issue with rural communities. Do they think differently than I do? Is their political ideology different than mine is? And what does that mean for me? And so I think that there's a little bit of distrust that, again, we go back into. If you don't understand where someone from a rural culture is coming from, they may fear that you misunderstand them. And if you misunderstand them, then how can you possibly provide services that are imperative for them? So acknowledging, yeah, family is really important. And so we've got to talk about this from the family perspective. So many of clients who've come in to see me for the first time still have that old Freudian idea that I'm going to have you come in, lay down on a couch and tell me all about your mother and all the horrible childhood things you've had and have experienced. And when you're dealing with someone who comes from a culture that really values family, if that's the perception around mental health, you kind of fight against that a little bit, that, that's really not my job. My job is to hear where you are, to understand where you are, and to help you get the resources in place to be where your goals are and where they align. So if we have providers who are coming into rural areas, a perfect example, and I know we'll talk about this as both a pro and a con for me. One of the ones I used to have a lot was people would come into my office, and the assumption was that if they came into my office, that I would take their guns away. And guns are a really big part of a rural culture. And so that was a reason that many people would say they actually didn't come in to begin with, because they believed that if they came in and talked to me about some of the difficulties they were having, and I'm not talking necessarily even at this point of suicidal ideation or even homicidal ideation, just in general. So I would get a question about, if you diagnosed me with, say, depression, what would that mean for my guns and my rights and different aspects? And so, kind of fighting against some of that as well, that this is where I am. I don't necessarily want a mental health person telling me what to do, was really important. I also think we kind of have to recognize that not always, and I think it's important to remember, again, rural is on a continuum here. There's a wide range of what's typical. But for a lot of people, a rural society for me still has a lot of a patriarchal component. So there's often still a male figurehead, often a grandparent, who may be responsible for the family and may feel that responsibility deeply. I remember a client I had hospitalized, a teenager, for suicide. And within a day or two, I got a call from the grandfather who was like, "Nope, we take care of our own. We don't do that." And, first of all, without in any way creating problems with confidentiality, just having to share, "Okay, I hear your concerns. I certainly can't address them specifically, but I also want you to acknowledge that we're here working towards the same goals, that my job is to show care and compassion for any client I have. And at the same time, I do have an ethical and legal responsibility if I feel like there's a concern to get assistance for that." But for a lot of people who are coming from that family-oriented culture, that's a really tough thing, because somehow it feels like a little bit of a loss of control. And how are you as a practitioner going to work within those confines and those boundaries to be able to provide the best quality care? And then I think the other thing is, I'm going to talk in a class later today about the idea of dual relationships. And I think we addressed this a little bit in the report as well. So a dual relationship as a practitioner occurs when I am both a counselor but have an external relationship with an individual in the community. And in a rural community, they're actually almost impossible to avoid. You're going to end up with dual relationships, because if you're in a town, as I often was, of 2,500 to 5,000 people, there may only be one mechanic in town, and that could be the person that I saw as a client. But I may have to take my car there because, the tire is falling off and I'm not going to make it to another community. So you've got to kind of recognize you're going to have those dual relationships, but they don't necessarily have to be negative. The community tends to want you to be a part of them. You're going to be more trusted if you are a part of the community, and you tend to gain that trust. So what I would tell clinicians as I was helping them prepare to go into rural communities is, it's really important that you show your face in an appropriate way. So you need to show up. I would always say, you're never going to get more credibility than when you show up for the local high school football game and you're there as a part of it, because football and rural tend to go hand in hand, as with many other sporting events. Or you're going to go to the American Legion pancake breakfast and you're just going to be a part of those things. Still recognizing I have a responsibility to all of my clients in these communities to both be present as a community member, but also to hold their confidentiality as sacred to their story, and making sure that that is not something that I'm ever sharing or even indicating, which can also be challenging. I had a client at one point who I must have walked by in Casey's. I have to be honest, I had no idea I'd walked by this client. And in the next session, they were like, "Why didn't you say hi to me?" And I'm like, "Oh, first of all, I didn't see you in this case." But in general, I actually wouldn't say hi to a client in public. And I usually tell them that at the beginning. They don't always remember. But I always tell clients, you make the first move. I never make the first move, because it's a small town. People know what I do. And sometimes people will assume if you say something to me that you could be a client. But that's up to you. If you choose to say hi, absolutely. But I won't be the one to do that. It's not that I'm being unfriendly. I just want you to know that this is just a way I'm protecting your privacy. And unfortunately, or fortunately, again, once you have the trust of the community, it's amazing, but they'll tell you anything as you're walking in Casey's. So you also have to be really cautious about that as well. So once you have that credibility established, I think they're very warm and opening and welcoming, but there is some distrust unless they know that you're willing to be a part of the community and that your care is not just seeing them as a client, but seeing them as a whole person.
Right, great. So now let's circle back a little to the topic of guns. We found, looking, and it's fairly well known that about half of the suicides are the person uses a gun. And let's talk a little bit about guns in rural areas, and impulsivity. When it comes to suicide, from what I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand, a person can be thinking about and even planning suicide for quite a while. But when it comes down to actually doing it, that may be an urge, an impulse that only lasts, can only, may only last minutes, or it may last a half an hour. So time is really crucial there. If a person overdoses on drugs or medication, there's still time to save that person. But when they use a gun, that's not necessarily the case. So why don't you talk a little bit more about that?
Okay. So obviously, guns and lethality are the biggest concern that it is often and most often lethal when someone chooses to use a gun to die by suicide. And you're right. I mean, when we go back and we look at things that happen, if someone were to overdose, then there is still the possibility of being helped or being saved if there is the possibility of being found. So with guns, that's much less so. And yet, it's such a concern for rural citizens who have believed for so long that, and again, continuum, not everyone in a rural community feels this way, but for many of them who are avid gun owners, that's a really difficult thing to have a discussion about. Impulsivity is one of the biggest concerns for me as the clinician. I work a lot with suicide plans, trying to make safety plans, trying to make sure that individuals can keep themselves safe. And I think we need to be really clear here that many people have thoughts of suicide. In fact, I would go as far as to say almost everyone on the planet at some point in time has had the thought of suicide. Some people have it situationally and continue to have it situationally. And then I have some clients who, frankly, have thoughts very chronically because of their particular mental health concerns or because situations they're in are pretty pervasive. They will have ongoing thoughts of suicide. Having thoughts of suicide versus having a plan and then having access to means are still really different things. So, if you have thoughts of suicide, we can often manage that. But part of managing that might be discussing what your access to means are. And if there are guns in the home, how can we work to manage that as well? So, for me, and again, most of my practice has been in Iowa, which does not have any type of law against like red flag laws or anything at this point. It's just been individually managing it with the clients. So we have talked about it. We found alternate places or alternate locations to keep weapons so that clients recognize, okay, I don't have that power, at least in Iowa, to take those guns from you. And no one is likely going to do that, but is there somewhere and someone that you would trust to hold your guns until we get past a crisis point? Because that's really what we're looking at is what's the crisis point? And when I'm working with clients and having those discussions, and in fact, when we talked to some of the farm counselors and some of the other counselors I met with during the part of this report, most of them have handled it that way as well, is that it's been an ongoing discussion. It's not a you must. But it's a, hey, we want to work to keep you safe during this time because what we know historically is in those impulsive moments when the crisis just hits a breaking point, if you have access to a gun, you're much more likely to die by suicide. So in most cases, we've been able to work with clients to say, let's find an alternate method for right now. I know you have them locked at home in a safe, but that might not be sufficient. We might need, you've got a relative, a parent that you might trust where you could leave them with that parent for the time being. But I think it's really important to acknowledge that if we can have the gun out of the home, preferably by choice of the client, particularly in a rural community, I think we have much better outcomes in those moments because we reduce that risk just by simply reducing the access to means.
Yeah, and I think what's so important to remember is that, at least in the research I was looking at, that impulse, that urge passes. You know, the person may feel that urge to, oh, I have to end it now, but it may be gone in 5 or 10 minutes. But, you know, if you use a gun, there's no going back from that, you know, and
Yeah.
you, yeah.
Well, and even we look at psychiatric holds, which tend to, on average, be 48 to 72 hours. Part of the reason for that time frame is researchers have learned the body itself can't stay in crisis forever. So at some point in time, even when we're starting to go into crisis, the body itself can't maintain that for more than about 48 to 72 hours. Now, for some people, particularly chronically suicidal people, the period of time between coming out of crisis and going back in can be very short. But we also know for people who go into a hospital setting that we anticipate that crisis will end. So, because of that, we're doing these in small measures. So, ongoing therapeutic intervention is still going to be important, even for people who come out of crisis. But you're absolutely right that those momentary decisions can end a life when that may or may not have been the case if we had limited some of that access to means, at least for the period of crisis that we're discussing.
It gives you a chance to help that person. Yeah. So now, one of the other themes that came out of your conversations with all the mental health experts that you talked to was anchor members of the community. So who are they and why are they so important?
So we kind of go back to some of the pieces that we've already talked about, Marnie, which is we talked about availability. Are there enough providers around? We've talked a little bit about accessibility, which is if there are providers, can I get an appointment? Do I have the financial means? And then we talked a little bit about the acceptability. But that acceptability piece is what makes anchor members of a community so important. So what we recognize and what was confirmed again in our interviews is that so many of mental health cases around suicide, that there is a person in their life that someone who is struggling with suicide has likely reached out to. Now, again, I want to make it very clear. There are some people who never reach out where people never know, because often family members feel a lot of guilt. Should I have seen the signs? And I think it's always imperative that we mention you may never know with a few cases. But in more cases than not, they have reached out to somebody. And that person is probably not a mental health practitioner. I used to tell people when I was doing presentations or talking about it in my communities in Iowa that I was never the first call. I mean, I'm not, people don't pick up the phone and call Dr. Tracy Rutherford Self, PhD. That's just not the first call unless they're already a client. But for new people who may not be working with a practitioner, and again, we know often they're not, they reach out to people they know and they trust. And those people could be the local clergy. I would say clergy probably get more people than maybe other than doctors in the community than probably just about anyone else. And I think medical doctors are another big one. A lot of times individuals will trust their local medical doctor, and so they'll reach out to them. But there are a lot of other people in these communities that if you trust them, you're going to reach out to. And that could be someone who was a teacher or a coach, or again, friends and family that people will reach out to. And so, what's really important for us from a societal perspective, and I think some great work is already being done in the state of Minnesota, is to continue to train everyday people on the idea of suicide. My favorite phrase, which is not mine, it came from John Summers Flanagan, who is a researcher at University of Montana. When he talks about suicide, he says to normalize, normalize, normalize. And what's really important about that is we still speak about suicide as though it's taboo, as though there's something wrong with a person who has thoughts of suicide, instead of recognizing how incredibly common those thoughts are. And frankly, under certain circumstances, pretty normal when you're having a really difficult set of circumstances. I will tell clients, you know, it's really common for someone who's facing difficulties the way you are to have thoughts of suicide. So, if we as a society can start talking about suicide as though it is normal, meaning commonly occurring, as opposed to, oh, you're having those thoughts, then I think we have different outcomes, frankly. And the other thing is we have to equip those anchor members to have those conversations. So one of the things we know is that people, including, frankly, even therapists who don't have training on how to deal with a suicidal crisis, won't ask the questions because they're so afraid of, what do I do if I find out someone's suicidal? I don't know how to have that conversation. So again, there's some really great programs and things that are happening. A lot of QPR training. So QPR is question, persuade, refer. And I know NAMI Minnesota is spearheading a lot of that. And it's amazing that we're having those conversations. So we need to continue to do so. We need to continue to equip those members, those anchor members of communities, and making sure that they have the ability to ask questions. Now, it's important to understand that anybody who's doing QPR, your job is not suicide assessment. Your job is not to make sure that the individual in front of you doesn't attempt suicide. Your job is simply to ask the questions and help refer them onto a provider who can be of help. And frankly, I think that's where the war is going to be won. I think as we continue to work more with anchor members in communities, what will happen is we'll be able to start having those conversations. And by having those conversations, we normalize the idea. And as we normalize the idea, we normalize the concept of getting help. But because there is no world in the next 10 years in which we are going to be able to supply rural communities, I think, with enough practitioners. I simply don't think there's enough practitioners for the need who are being graduated from universities at this point. And we have, as we know from previous reports, a high number of individuals who are going to be retiring, particularly in the state of Minnesota, over the next 5 to 10 years without the number of practitioners needed to replace them. And it's already very hard to recruit students to go into those areas if they aren't coming from rural communities. And because of that, likely the shortage is going to continue to some extent. I think there are things we're working really hard on. I know MinState is, I know around the country, other universities, the federal government, the state governments are looking really hard at how we can we put more people into these communities. And that's phenomenal. Let's increase that. Let's increase availability of providers. But while we're doing it, there's a population of people who already exist in rural communities, who already have the trust of rural communities, and those are our anchor members that we can start to equip to better help the citizens in their communities in order to be able to access care that is available.
And so that leads into, I think, my final question. What can we as individuals do? We haven't talked about 988 yet, and you're talking about referring. How do those two things go together?
I think 988 is an absolutely phenomenal tool in all of this. You know, I started my mental health career as a crisis line worker. It wasn't 988 at that point. It was still based like at a county level. And part of that is really what informed, I think, my interest in working with clients who were suicidal was it's such a great work having that particular resource, because there are some people, as we talk about this, who may never reach out to 988 because of some distrust. And there are other people who are actually going to prefer it and may like the little idea of that anonymity. And so what's great about the state of Minnesota, as we continue to roll out that 988 information, I think it's really important to acknowledge that those centers are being ran by other Minnesotans. It's not going to a federal level. It's not like it's going to some major database across the country or in Atlanta or Chicago. It's going to your backyard in Minnesota. And it's people from Minnesota who have been trained to address some of these needs and to help provide resources. And as we go back to what you were saying before, Marnie, this idea that these are sometimes momentary decisions. It's that moment. It's that buildup. It's the getting to crisis. And 988 is available 24/7. There's always someone there to answer your call. And what we know from the report is individuals from other clinicians who said, hey, yeah, I've had individuals who've used the number and they've been able to call. And they picked up right away, and we were able to get help for that crisis in the immediate, because it normalizes it. You're going to talk to me. And as you and I talk about it, what happens is those thoughts of suicide often swirl in people's heads. It's just there. And it's like this running loop when you're in crisis. So if we can break the loop, one of the ways of breaking it is by utilizing 988 and being able to have that loop broken by having that conversation with somebody so it's not stuck in your head anymore. There's amazing research that talks about the way the brain processes information. And part of the way it processes it is I can share with you. So if you and I are here and Marnie, you're my person I call and I'm talking to you and I'm saying, I'm thinking about dying and these thoughts are here and you start to say, let's talk through this. Tell me a little bit more about it. And I know you're here in Minnesota and you're a person who cares about me and my well-being. It'll shift that tape that's running in people's head almost immediately. And most people report after that conversation, they're able to substantially decrease those thoughts of suicide. So I think 988 is one of the most important tools in our arsenal for that immediate in the moment crisis. And the other great thing about 988 is it can make referrals to community members and it can help with, okay, what are my next steps? What are the things I need to do? Because in those moments of crisis, you can't think beyond that immediate, I feel like I want to die. That's as far as you can get. So having someone help you walk through, okay, let's talk about this. Let's get you some help. What does even getting help look like? Because in that moment, it's 3 a.m. You can't just call a practitioner and schedule an appointment. And often, even if you do, you could be weeks away from that appointment. I need help today. And that is the beauty of what 988 does, is it gets us that help today in the immediate. It helps us sort of stop that loop that's playing. And the great thing is, look, if it starts again, if you've made it 24 hours and you find it starts again while you're waiting to get into a facility or you're waiting to get some additional assistance, you can call again and you can call as many times as you need in order to get that help. And for some people, like I said, it's really momentary things that are happening and that crisis may pass. And in rural communities, there's so many things that could be coming up right now. You know, we didn't talk about this before, but as we look at the uptick, I mean, the way inflation is working, the financial pressure on families, and particularly looking at like farm families and what that looks like, and citizens in rural communities who traditionally have a lower socioeconomic status. You know, that's a pervasive issue that's going to be ongoing. So thoughts of suicide may return as a new bill suddenly comes in the mail that someone may not have the need to pay for. And so as you're opening that and it's 10 p.m. at night, having access to a 24/7 hotline is an amazing opportunity for people.
Yeah, and it's not just suicide, right? You can call about any kind of mental health crisis that you're having, right?
That is correct. It can be any type of mental health crisis. And I don't even know if I want to use the word crisis. I think it can be any type of mental health concern. And even when I was working our crisis line, and this was way more than decades ago than I want to admit at this moment, but even when I was working it, we had a group of citizens who were a little older, retired, who just didn't have the same level of connection that they might have wanted to have. And I had one who would call almost every day just to check in. Hey, this is what's going on, or went to my doctor today, and it would be a 5-minute conversation. But it was an individual who, without that kind of support or that ability to contact somebody, would have been suicidal. But this was kind of a proactive way of keeping that from happening.
Yeah. So the 988 number is being, it's in service now. Mm-hmm. But they're rolling out the promotion of it now into greater Minnesota. It's been promoted a little more. It's like you said, the number has been around for a while, but it was only just changed to 988 in 2022. And so now they're rolling out promotions to get people familiar with it. So that's great. What else? I mean, just in terms of awareness,
I think if there was any kind of last words that I would say to people, if you're having thoughts of suicide, it's not something you can typically do on your own. I mean, you want to. And again, particularly in rural cultures where that is such a part of the community, I want to do it on my own. But this is a burden that really needs to be shared, whether it's with a professional like me or any of the other individuals that we certainly talk to during the course of the report. That's ideal. But reach out to somebody. If you're struggling, if you're having thoughts, start with 988 if you're not sure you want to talk to anybody in person. It's an amazing opportunity. I also do want to go back out and point out, not only can you do a phone call, they also have a text option. And we know the text option has increased substantially. And I think a lot of that is driven by people who aren't sure they actually want to have a phone conversation just yet. But you can reach out to 988 by text. But if not there, then reach out to other members of your community. So reach out to someone you trust to have that conversation. But definitely, this is not one you can do on your own. You need the support. And frankly, you're worth the support of other people.
Well, thank you so much, Tracy, and thanks for all your work on the paper. And oh, and we are going to be having, we're recording this on a Monday. Tomorrow, Tuesday, March 5th, we're going to be having a webinar on this. Now, unfortunately, the podcast will come out after the webinar, but maybe by the time this comes out, we'll have the video of the webinar ready. And that will also be on our website, ruralmn.org. And you'll be on there, Tracy, along with some other people who are experts in this area. And yeah, so thanks for much that. Thanks so much for being on today. And
Thanks, Marnie. It's been a great project, and I certainly hope we reach a lot of people.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.